So when my son was no more than 5 years old, my mother, because my mother thinks that she's funny, and in all fairness, she is kind of funny, my mother decided it would be a good idea to get him a new game for his Wii, which was called the Michael Jackson Experience. And the way the game worked was, you had the little Wiimotes in your hand, and as you went through the game, you could do the motions, and you would earn points. Well, then you can use the points to cash in to open up tutorials of how to do Michael Jackson's moves. Does that make sense? So my son is very meticulous by nature. He loves to dive into very specific, tactile things. And he spent hours upstairs, in the den upstairs, practicing his Michael Jackson moves. And eventually would come down and show us and let us know what was going on, and I grew more and more uncomfortable. Until the day, it gets better. Until the day he marched down, and again, he's 5 years old, right? And came into the downstairs little small TV room that we had, and he was like, "Daddy, I know what I want to be for a living." "What is that, son?" "I want to be a dancer. All I want to be, Daddy, is a dancer." And I remember exactly how I responded to him. He and I have talked about this experience a number of occasions since that time. The first thing I said to him when he informed me of this, I said, "First of all, son, let's get one thing clear. Don't ever tell anyone what you just told me." Okay? And second of all, no, you are not going to be a dancer. Now, what really struck about that in my mind was, and what I've continued to think about since that time, was the power that I possessed and held over my son to instinctually, very instinctually, inform what I wanted his models to look like. Somehow, through my mother's experience, it's his grandmother's fault from start to finish, he had sort of decided that there was a model out there of greatness, of excitement in Michael Jackson that he wanted to embody. And yet, that desire to do so met the force of my resistance and shaped him in who knows how many ways, obviously probably for the worse, as a father in our relationship in that regard. And what I began to realize was the models in our lives tend to become the most vivid whenever we reach great turning points in our own personal histories. Like I'd mentioned last night, Jeremy Jones, to whom I'm indebted a lot to a lot of the material here, talks a lot about where the influence of models will show up in our daily lives. And he throws out a handful, about five of them. He said, you can begin to watch for your models as you look at your choice of career. Why did you choose that path in life? What role models played that out in your decisions? What image were you following when you stepped up into that role? Secondly, what are the measures that you use to decide whether or not you have been a success in the career that you're following? For many people, obviously, it's very financial. For other people, it's a material lifestyle that you can afford. It's translated into a certain home, a certain car, certain vacations that you're able to take. What measures do I use to evaluate my role as a person, as a successful person? Thirdly, Jeremy says that you've got to look at the things that you're ashamed about. Because where and how deeply we feel deep shame usually comes because we're failing to live up to the glory of the idol that we're grasping at. And eventually, as that thing begins to fail, especially when it's an ideal of masculinity or maleness or whatever, shame sort of comes as our model begins to condemn us. That's what's going on. In other words, we begin to realize that we fall short of our idol's glory. And that's when we feel shame. Fourthly, there's our physical life. We don't spend much time thinking about this. But how do you think about your relationship to your body or fitness or CrossFit or the gym? How does it come out in the way in which we view and or treat women? How does it come out in our view of our sexuality, the idea of what even the definition of good sex is? It's a little bit complicated, we learned. How do we evaluate or see or even desire female bodies of what kind? And then fifthly, we have to look at how we talk about our conflict. That is, how do I handle conflict? What do I do when I'm offended by another person? What is that short fuse, that temper really about inside of me? What are those things leading me to? But the point is, You are acting like somebody. There is a script that you are following, that you believe, that you're channeling so that you can sound like and look like and act like that model. And oftentimes we find that in the moments of great success and great advancement in life, those are the moments where we reveal those models most clearly. Sometimes they can be good, sometimes they can be bad. Almost always they're a mixture. And the reason I want to mention this is because I want to talk about a scene in the life of David. And I wish I could have kind of polled a few of you last night to see what you expected me to go to. Because last night I wanted to talk about Moses and the great failure of his life that came at the very end of his life. And I think you kind of expect to be like, oh, we're going to do David and Bathsheba then, right? That was his big failure. But I think there's an argument to be made that there was a greater failure that David met early on in his particular kingship, especially as it occurs to us in 2 Samuel chapter 6. So turn there in your various eye devices if you don't mind. To set this up, you have to understand that David has just become king. Only in the last couple of chapters has he ascended to the throne. He's unified the entire country around his leadership. He has reached the pinnacle of all of his dreams as a young person. He is at the top of everything he could be. And we look at him, we think, surely this is a man that we should emulate. But there's another lesson that he has to learn that shows that it's very possible to get everything that you've dreamed of and miss the central guiding principle of every human being, of every Christian, and that is the centrality of the gospel. So let me see if I can unpack this in 2 Samuel 6. It's one, 2 Samuel 6. It's one of those passages that oftentimes throws people off as you get through it. So let's dive into it. David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000, and David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned on the cherubim. And they carried the ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on a hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were driving the new cart with the ark of God, and Ahio went before the ark. And David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines, castanets and cymbals. And when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah put out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God struck him down there because of his error, and he died there beside the ark of God. And David was angry because the Lord had broken out against Uzzah. And that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? So David was not willing to take the ark of the Lord into the city of David, but David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. And the ark of the Lord there remained for the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, for 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. And it was told King David, the Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God. So David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. And when those who bore the ark of the Lord had gone 6 steps, he sacrificed an ox and a fattened animal. And David danced before the Lord with all his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. So David with all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the horn. As the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. And they brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And when David had finished offering the burnt offerings and peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts and distributed among all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both men and women, a cake of bread, portion of meat and a cake of raisins to each one. Then all the people departed, each to his house, and David returned to bless his household. But Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, how the king of Israel has honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself. David said to Michal, it was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as a prince over Israel, the people of God. And I will celebrate before the Lord. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes. But by the female servants of whom you've spoken, by them I shall be held in honor. And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. Grass withers and flowers fall, but the word of our God stands forever. A number of years ago, actually probably 20-some-odd years ago, I heard Tim Keller preach a sermon on this very passage. And a lot of this is a lot of riff off of what I gleaned from that particular sermon. But I want to unpack four arcs in this amazing story of what happens to King David in his relationship with the ARK, the Ark of the Covenant. And the first one that I want you to draw from the text is this idea that David at the beginning of his ministry recognizes that there is no greater need that he has than to have the Ark of the Covenant inside Jerusalem. And so what he does in the response to this is he assembles this massive crowd, 30,000 men. There's a lot of activity that's going on here around the Ark of the Covenant. Why? Because David understood something foundational in his desire to establish the tone of his kingship. And that is that you honestly cannot have any kind of real unity unless people live in the presence of God. That there is something about God's physical presence being amongst his people that's going to be absolutely a tone setting for his ministry. Exodus 25, 22, God promised to Moses, I will meet with you over the mercy seat. That was the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. And of course, Moses, in response to this, you know, God told that he was not willing to sort of leave any place unless God went with them. Remember Moses looking and saying, look, God, if you don't go with us out of this place, it's not worth us going to the promised land if you won't be there. And David intuitively understands that this. He knows that the Ark of the Covenant was the vision of the symbolic presence of God. We know from the Old Testament there were two associations that the people of God had with the Ark. The first one, it was associated with God's guidance. You remember when the children of Israel used to travel throughout the wilderness, that there was a cloud that was the visible presence of God that would rest right over the Ark whenever they were at rest and were told to stop. But when it picked up and moved, at nighttime, of course, it became a great ball of fire, they moved along with wherever it went. And so the Ark became this idea that was setting at the front of all of their travels. We weren't gonna make a move into any future destiny if we don't know the presence of God is what we're pursuing. And then secondly, it was also associated as a divine warrior. This got him into a little bit of trouble later on. But when the Jews entered the promised land, especially in sort of taking the city of Jericho, the first thing that leads the way is the Ark of the Covenant. So the Jews begin to look at the Ark as if it was this sort of symbol of miraculous victory that only Yahweh was going to be able to bring to them. Even as far forward as the book of Revelation 11, you find that the Ark appears as creation convulses with the appearance of King Jesus. It's the conquering aspect of it. And so for all of those reasons, David stands up. And I don't think it's over the top to say David lusted for this thing. There was nothing else that he wanted than to bring the presence of God and to know that what he and all Israel, and actually all humankind for that matter, were made to experience. What's the lesson? David is telling us that each and every one of us was built to live and exist inside the very presence of God. There is nothing more central to your manufacturer's design than to live in the presence of God, to live as it were before his face, where the Latin folks say coram Deo. Even as far back as you go diving through, you realize that like David's trying to say, do not put your faith in our military might. Don't come up here and look. Put your faith in me as a morally upstanding character. All you get is your strength coming from the Lord. And David looks up and says, this is gonna be the mark of my kingship. This is what I want it to be about. And so David says, I want to place a very powerful symbol in the center of that municipal architecture of the tribes of Israel and sort of come in and let that symbol be for them what his kingship was all about. By the way, that's what public symbols do. Anyway, they always unify people around the meaning of that symbol. But here's the point. If David was built for that, it means you and I were built for the same thing as well. The presence of God is the need behind every other need in our humanity. All of our deepest longings, whether they're for some kind of relationship, whether for some kind of significance, some kind of security, can only be met by what you were designed to live by. So much so that C.S. Lewis will look and say that if you don't get first things first and you put second things first, then those second things are always going to be corrupted. His famous line is, if you aim at heaven, you'll actually get heaven with earth thrown in. But if you aim at earth, you'll get neither heaven nor the thing you were wanting in the first place. That's the nature of this connection. There's something huge to begin to dig into. And I'm granting that it's an expression of Christian piety to ask this question about all of my fear and all of my worry and all of my anxiety and all of my anger and all of my depression, all of my insecurity and all of my frustration can ultimately be traced back to worshiping something other than the Creator. To not finding my greatest identity living in the presence of God and longing for that more than anything else that could possibly present itself to me. So David says at the very outset, and here's the thing I want you to understand. David was right. And what he wanted was correct. It was a godly desire that he was after for him to do so. But then all of a sudden you come to the second point of the problem. We can see the need that is for the ark, but we find it turns out that there is a problem with the ark. And what a problem it is. You know, a number of years ago, I was in a Bible study. This actually was when I was in college, many years ago. And it was a group of people in the Bible study, of men who were going through significant life struggles. There was a guy who was going through a divorce. There was a guy who had reached sort of the limits of what psychological counseling could do for him. He was just a very broken man. There was another guy named Mike Robbins who was number one on the list to get a liver transplant. It was amazing how sick he looked. He had this very yellow hue to his body. And in Memphis, of course, at that time was one of the number one places to get a liver transplant. And he was number one on the list. He was the next guy to get one. And it was amazing to hear him talk about his testimony because he said, you know, I can't tell you what it's like to long and need something without which I'm going to die. But I can't just go down to Walmart and pick up a new liver. Someone else has got to sacrifice in some way for me ever to live at all. And it really resonated with me. And I thought about it ever since that time because the very thing that he needed the most was the thing he couldn't have. And that's where David is. David knows, and I'm suggesting to you, is correct in saying, what I need the most is the presence of God, and that's the very thing that he can't have. Because as he comes up and begins to walk through, as they come through, there's something that innocent happens. The cart on which the ark is placed, I don't know, it hits a pothole. Maybe the oxen that are pulling it lurch for a second, and the thing teeters a little bit. And so what appears to be this very well-meaning gesture by, you know, one of the members of the youth group, we got us in Ohio, they're gonna walk alongside the ark, right? All of a sudden it stumbles, I'll get it. Suddenly he's zapped and dies there, and everyone around knows that it was because that he touched the ark. And they, can you imagine that they scream and start to back away from this? And your first question is like, why in the world that happened? And I'm gonna tell you why it happened. Because David broke all the rules. When God created and told Moses how to make the Ark of the Covenant, he also gave very specific rules on how it was to be moved. That was, they were supposed to move the thing using poles going through rings, not a cart. They were supposed to use priests that were supposed to only move it, not youth group leaders. They were supposed to go through literally days of consecration before they ever moved it, not a big celebration and party. And most of all, and most important of all, no one was ever supposed to touch the ark. So here's my question to you next. Is that satisfying to you? Oh, they broke the rules. That's why he executed the leader of the youth group. That's why God did that. Does that satisfy you? Because I think what you end up getting, especially in certain Old Testament stories, is you're like, what is up with this God and his rules? Because I think it's fair to say David meant well, didn't he? Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, I don't know. But they say to themselves, we have got to get rid of a God like this. Someone this arbitrary and this nitpicky, that he would punish someone to that degree, can that ever be thought of as just in anybody's universe? But what we've got to wrestle in through, and this is what David, I think, is navigating his way through, is that God's rules exist for a reason. because the principles behind the rules are deeply tied to their administration. In other words, God gives his rules for a reason, because those rules are coming to preach a message. All the time when God gives instructions for his people to follow very carefully what he said to do so, he's doing it because he's trying to say, I need for you to get a grasp over the seriousness of your sin, and that your sin is not something that is light for me to deal with. And so I've got to find a way to show you how foolish it is for you to think that there will ever be access to me under any other terms than the ones that I set. Because the only other option, and again, I realize that even that sounds strict, the only other option is to fashion a religion that's like every other world religion. In other words, every other world religion is going to come along and basically say, okay, I got some things I want, and you better pony up, because I'm a cranky deity who needs your appeasement, right? For you to come and give me, you know, your my pound of flesh in it all, and eventually you're going to look up and honor me in that particular way. But it's as if God is going to David and saying, David, please understand something. I am not cranky. I am holy. And that's different. There is no way for you to come into my presence, this thing that you need more than anything else in the world, unless you do so by the ways in which I have ordained. So no, I don't think that David and Uzzah had good intentions when they were coming into the presence of God, because they were risking the kingdom getting a version of God that was lethal to them. Why? Because this episode showed that what they were thinking was that this was a God who could be managed. What David is doing is by the big parade, and I mean, it is a new cart, right? He did use one of the old ones. We made you this new cart, and do you hear that music? And look at all these people. What's he doing? He's appeasing. And what God is saying is, if you take that approach to me, it's going to kill you, and it's going to dehumanize the people in your kingdom. Why? Well, think about it. If David rejects grace and lives by whatever standards sort of that he set up for himself, let's say that he's the kind of king that does pretty well with those standards. What does he end up becoming? He becomes cold, does he not? He gets proud because he's doing better, because he's earned it. And the second that you have that, you have sown the seeds in your heart to look down on others. Your kingship, your authority, will be one of condescension. I've done better than you have. Why don't you be like me? Follow me. Christians don't talk that way. The second option is if all of a sudden David does pretty well and for some reason his life doesn't go the way in which he thought it should, then all of a sudden he's sown the seeds of eventually leaving God, because Christianity just didn't work for me. I tried that. I had a conversation with somebody this week who was saying that. It's like, you know what? I look at Christianity like I do an old, you know, boyfriend from college. We had a great time together. That was really helpful. But you know, I've kind of grown past it. Talking about Christianity and their faith. What are they saying? It stopped working for me, because somewhere along the way, they looked and saw, I did pretty well without you. All of the things that you were sort of binding me about, I don't need anymore. That wrecks relationships. Finally, let's say your standards that you set up for yourself, you fail at, and you spend all of your time feeling crushed and dejected and guilty. Well, if that's the case, then you've sowed the seeds of bitterness that's just basically going to keep us fighting. Because when I live in the midst of guilt, guilt is by nature a repellent. If I feel guilty around you or because of you, I don't want to be anywhere near you. And so guilt begins to erode the heart. And so here's the point. It's as if God is saying to David, David, you either will worship me as a God of complete grace that requires you to admit your profound and bottomless need of me, or you can fashion a religion on your own terms and you become an agent of the destruction of the world around you. That's it. Those are the only two options. And living in the presence of God will have nothing of it. So what's the lesson for us? The lesson for us is, has the holiness of God disturbed you? Have you ever found yourself at a moment reeling, as it were, under the weight of a God who takes his law this seriously? We have to grapple with this on a regular basis, that without holiness, no one will see the Lord, writer of Hebrews says. And that holiness has this way of stripping away whatever it is that we've taken into his presence to leverage his favor. See, that's what we do, don't we? And I know we do it. When's the last time you decided, I'm going to spend a season in prayer? This time we'll go a whole 10 minutes. New levels of spirituality. But now as you start, what often do you do? How often do you kind of leaf through your recent behavior? What rights do I have to be here? And we begin to all of a sudden look and realize, you know, a couple nights ago, that was not a good night. Maybe I should wait. In other words, we work through this and not recognizing the fact that his holiness starts to strip away anything that I thought was going to come in and make him like me. We console ourselves. Well, at least I'm not as bad as so-and-so. Or, you know, I was sincere. I repented. God's holiness comes in as like, yeah, no. George Whitefield was the one who said, actually, God could condemn you for the best prayer you ever prayed. Your repentance needs to be repented of. So David gets a big gulp of this particular thing in the problem of the ark. Thirdly, though, there actually is good news in the ark. Because David asked the right question. Did you notice it? How can the ark of God ever come to me? And it says that David was angry. Who was David angry at? I'm sure if you asked him that question, there was a host of anger. He was probably angry at God. Maybe he was angry at Uzzah for being so foolish. But you know what my guess is anger, David was probably angry at himself. So what happens is we've got to get to a point in my life where I ask that question, how can the ark of God ever come to me? That's essential. And so God causes something to happen. Because the ark, once the sort of whole incident happens, is given to the house of Obed-Edom, which I really wish I could have been there after the scene, right? Everybody's celebrating, dancing, Uzzah touches the ark, pow, he knocks over dead. Everybody shrieks and kind of backs away from it. And David's like, oh, this is terrible. He's angry at the Lord. What are we gonna do with the ark? I don't know, let's give it to Obed-Edom. And he had to be kind of like, oh, I'm fine without it. Like, if you wanna give it to somebody else, that's cool. But this is what's crazy. Apparently it goes to his house and everything works right for Obed-Edom. Kids are well-adjusted, brought home good grades. Wife is especially, you know, attentive to him, as we say. His business dealings all go well. You know, all of his income goes up. Everything is going well for Obed-Edom, and God makes sure that David hears about it. And they're like, you know what? Actually, I think the ark of God is not there to curse us. It's there to bless us, David. And so David rethinks it. So this story is actually told in the book of 1 Chronicles in a parallel passage. And what we find there is David actually went back to the law and read the rules. He got everything he was supposed to get. He got the priests. He had the priests get consecrated. He put the poles in the side of it and covered it the way in which it was going to be covered. The little detail that we get in our passage that I love, though, is it says that those priests hadn't taken 6 steps before they stopped the parade and sacrificed an animal. Now, that's one of those weird details you get in the Bible that you want to be like, 6 steps? Why would you include that detail? Well, to the Jewish Hebrew mind, 7 is a whole number. It's a number of perfection and fullness. And it's as if David is saying, we are not going to make any real progress on this journey up to the final resting place of the ark until we make a sacrifice. So think about that. Every 6 step, there's a sacrifice. What must that bloody trail have looked like on the way to Jerusalem? David actually understands that this burnt offering was a way of going to an animal and identifying with the animal. David was to stand over it with his hands and transfer his sins over to it and saying, I should die, but this thing's gonna die in my stead. It actually reminded me of that story in Numbers 21 when the children of Israel are trying to travel up out of the wilderness area and they start to complain again before God sends snakes into the camp. You remember the story? They're biting the Israelites. They're dying in droves. And Moses does as he always does and goes and complains to God, please save them, don't crush them. And God decides he's going to. He's going to do so. But here's what I want you to do, Moses. I want you to take and fashion for yourself a bronze snake. And I want you to wrap that snake around a pole, hold it up at the beginning of the camp, and just tell people to look at it. And as soon as they look at it, they'll be healed. And they did, and they were healed. A weird Old Testament story. But you know what's the most weird about that? Why were they told to look up at a snake when a snake was their problem? In other words, why look up at the very thing that is killing you? Well, I can tell you what Martin Luther said about it. Martin Luther said that the reason why they were told to look up at a snake is because they didn't realize that the poison that was pumping through their veins had an analogy with the sin that was pumping through their hearts. And they were told to look up at the very thing that curses them. And therefore, every Christian must then so, he said, clothe Christ in our sins, that suddenly I see him up there being me. So I was sitting in my office, this is 20 years ago, with a college student who was facing up to a very reckless sexual lifestyle. Before there was apps for Tinder, Grindr, whatever the thing is these days, there were little places where gay men on campus could get together and hook up anonymously. And this young man, though a professing Christian, came into my office, was wrecked with his behavior, didn't know how to control it. But his anxiety would get so bad that he would literally start to ball up. And he would finally end up in the corner of my office, almost catatonic, trying to wrestle through what he had done. And I remember him saying at one point during our conversation, Les, you really don't understand what it's like to wake up every single morning and have the first word that enters your mind be the word pervert. You're a pervert. And there was a lot to work through. And I mean, I'm talking a lot to work through. And this was not a magical conversation. But the only time I felt like I made a dent was when I said, look, it may very well be that one of the problems here is you have not seen Jesus being your perversion on the cross. And he said to me, that sounds blasphemous. And I said, actually, that's right. It's supposed to. It's a stumbling block for lots of people. But until you look and see him being your perversion, we do not say that he was being perverted because he knew no sin. But in 2 Corinthians 5, the thing is, he who knew no sin became sin for us. So my identification, my sort of grasp of what it means to be in union with Jesus has to begin by seeing my sin on him so that when God judges him for it, he judges my sin. And in judging my sin, when he's raised again, I'm raised again into newness of life. There was a great experiment that was done a while back by a group of researchers who put students into a dark room and told them to imagine certain scenes. And there were these lasers that were put on their eyes to measure what they were doing. And if they told them to imagine a sunny day, even in the midst of pitch black darkness, their pupils would actually constrict. If they told them to imagine a dark and stormy day or maybe a dark room in their house, their pupils would dilate. And what they were saying was, is that even our imagination can help move things in our bodies. How I see myself. How do you see Christ? And how does that affect me in the way in which I live and walk before his presence? So this is the solution to the problem. Finally, and one last point before I close, there's a great joy. You'll know when you get the gospel because there is a joy that comes that makes David forget himself. And that joy is most found in beginning to be comfortable mixing with other people from a different social existence. This is what happens to David. What it says there in the passage is that David goes down and starts to hang out with the slaves, the female slaves of slaves. So you got all the worst things. You got a slave, you got the slave of a slave, and you got a woman of a slave. David is with what everybody would consider the lowest form of social existence, and he's down there dancing. And Michal, of course, daughter of Saul, his lovely wife, reminds him that he's doing so unclothed. Now, that doesn't mean that he was naked. That would be a problem. When it says unclothed, it means that David had removed any sort of kingly wrapping that would have made people think that he was the king. So in other words, David didn't need any kind of outward distinguishment. And Michal hates it. She's been to the King Saul school of kingship. And she's like, this is not how it's done. You got to actually let people know. Otherwise, you're vulgar. That doesn't mean like dirty. It means that you're common. You're down there with the common folk. And David is saying, Michal, I don't need their respect. But here's the crazy thing. Because I've gotten to a place where I don't need their respect, because now I know I have the respect of the God of the universe, I'm going to get it anyway. Do you notice what he said? These slave girls that you talk about, they'll actually hold me in honor. But the truth of the matter is, I'm gonna be more abased than this. I love that line. King David, at the very beginning of his ministry, looks and goes, hey, you're noticing that there's sin in me? You ain't seen nothing yet. There's plenty more where that came from. Reminds me of that C.H. Spurgeon story where Spurgeon is outside of his church, big London pastor, right? And everybody's sort of passing by him, doing what you do at the end of a sermon. Oh, thank you for coming, blah, 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 blah. And one lady walks up to Spurgeon and is kind of like, I just want you to know, Mr. Spurgeon, I think you're the most arrogant, conceited, boastful man I've ever met in my entire life, and I wanted to be the one to tell you. And she turns on her heel and marches away. Well, everybody's quiet. Spurgeon leans over to the elder next to him and goes, she doesn't know the half of it. Now we're laughing, why? We're laughing because we're like, I want to hang out with a guy like Spurgeon. Don't we? Because he didn't have a chip on his shoulder. Because the gospel has gotten into that place where he's able to come in and be literally supernaturalized in his character. He can look at the world in a way in which he never could have before. That's the difference between what happens when the joy sort of gets us. Jeremiah 3:16 says there was going to come a day where the Ark of the Covenant was never going to be missed and no one would ever make another one because all it would be is an artifact. That's where we find ourselves. Why? Because Jesus comes by his Holy Spirit to bring us into the same presence of God. And without that experience at the midst of our huge moments in life, the gospel doesn't come home. And if it doesn't come home, we're going to follow all the wrong models. Is David a model? Yeah. In lots of ways, yes. Read the Psalms. Is David not a model? No, he's also a failure. How do you bring those together? We're going to work on that in the last session. Let me pray for us. The Lord, give us grace as we continue to work, continue to think through exactly what you'd have us to be. For we ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen.